It's 1 o'clock, Champaign-Urbana, time to jump to Media Matters. We've got a live show for you today, this December 4th, 2011, and our guest is going to be a frequent guest we've had on the air before, Morris Berman, author of Why America Failed, The Roots of Imperial Decline, a penetrating critique of this country, its history, and its future, which appears rather nebulous. Join us today for the full hour, if you will, looking forward to it. But before we go to our guests, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Could it be that the days of rubber-stamping mega telecommunications mergers in Washington, D.C. are over? Maybe not. But for AT&T, at least, the hiccups disrupting its plan to purchase wireless competitor T-Mobile just keep coming. 2 days before Thanksgiving, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Julius Genachowski circulated a draft order calling for an administrative hearing for the proposed merger between AT&T and T-Mobile. Free Press Policy Director Matt Wood explains.
The FCC has a strange set of procedures they have to go through to deny a merger. Before they can deny a merger, they actually have to designate it for a hearing and basically give the merger applicants a chance to make their case in front of an administrative law judge. Most parties never have to do this. It's something that is very rare and something that the FCC generally doesn't do because they tend to approve mergers or put conditions on them even if they approve them. What the FCC did in this case was start that process last week of designating the AT&T T-Mobile merger for a hearing. And usually this is really the kiss of death for a merger because parties just don't want to go through it. It's a very laborious and time-intensive process, something that it's really hard to win in if you're the merger applicant.
The next plot twist? Barely 24 hours after Genachowski issued his order, AT&T made its next move, withdrawing its application from the FCC.
In order to avoid having the FCC's hearing designation order come out, and to avoid facing the music at the FCC and starting down that long path I was just describing, AT&T and T-Mobile said, we hereby withdraw our applications. We might come back again later with the same deal, but right now you can't rule on this because we've taken away our applications. We're not in front of the FCC anymore.
It was a move equivalent to the old, you can't fire me because I quit technique.
The FCC really saw through that to their credit and took a reasonably bold step here because it decided to release the staff report, is how it's been framed now. Really, it would have been part of the order that would have come out if AT&T and T-Mobile hadn't kind of cut and run there last week. And they said, you know, you said that the deal is still alive, that you might come back to us, and therefore we here at the commission don't want to bury all the work that we've done. We want to release the findings we've made thus far based on all the evidence that we've seen.
The report doesn't have any binding legal implications, Wood said, but it's safe to say that AT&T has a long road ahead if they plan to continue pursuing this merger.
Most newspapers have guidelines that prohibit the overuse of unnamed sources and stories. To be quoted in a paper of record, you've got to be willing to go on the record. But a new expose in Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's Extra magazine finds that two of the leading mainstream newspapers aren't always following their own rules. Writer Janine Jackson reviewed a week of front-page stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post. 23% of the stories, 18 out of 77, quoted at least one anonymous source. Jackson said that's a remarkably high number for a practice journalists are told to reserve for extreme circumstances.
So here's this rule that they're supposed to follow, and what you find is that they break the rule virtually every day. Officials are anonymous because the situation they're talking about is tense. They're anonymous because they just don't want to go on the record. They're anonymous for all kinds of reasons that don't sound very legitimate and that raise tremendous concern about whether our government officials are really accountable.
Most of the anonymity was extended to government officials commenting on foreign policy and U.S. military activity. And journalists, it appears, are bowing to the pressure to keep sources anonymous.
It definitely served government officials to be able to shroud their actions in secrecy. And I think journalists have simply gone along with it in order to maintain access to those sources.
Jackson says this abuse of anonymity in the press hurts the public's ability to actually know what's going on in the world and to challenge it.
If we're up against nameless, faceless forces, it becomes much harder to identify allies, to understand what's being done, to understand who we can fight against if we disagree with them. I think it contributes to a kind of squelching in general of people's political energy.
Jackson urges the public to contact their newspaper if they see an outrageous abuse of anonymity. But she says the fight for a more transparent press runs deeper.
At the same time, we really have to be rejecting this whole culture of cronyism that exists between high-level corporate journalists and the government officials that they're meant to be scrutinizing. They have a closeness that is institutional, that is decades old, and really at this point, I think the efforts are to get our information around that set of sources and from other outlets, along with challenging the information that they provide.
To read Jackson's story, visit www.fair.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. Our guest today has been on the show a couple times before with the first two volumes of his trilogy. And here we're here to talk about the third volume of this trilogy. Our guest, Morris Berman, author of Why America Failed, The Roots of Imperial Decline, just released by Wiley Books. Morris Berman, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me on, Bob.
And you're down in Mexico, is that correct?
That's right.
All right, so Carlos Slim is doing us the favor of letting us have a good connection. That's great.
Something like that.
Morris Berman, your first two books, and we had you on there in this trilogy, you've written several books, are The Twilight of American Culture and also Dark Ages America. This book, Why America Failed, The Roots of Imperial Decline. Yes, I read the book, and like your other books, an absolute pleasure to read.
Thank you.
But as I read it, what was interesting to me is it struck me that a subplot, maybe not even sub, is for the entire tenor of American debate, left and right, across the spectrum, which starts from the presumption that there is basically something ultimately great in the dominant American experience that we can glean, and that's where our future is found. This is really, it's like a bucket of ice water saying, you've got it wrong. There's just really something fundamentally not great there that's really driving everything. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the argument that I make in Why America Failed is that from the late 16th century, it was always a hustling culture. It was always an entrepreneurial...
Wait, you mean late 17th, because you're predating the Puritans right now.
Yeah, I'm talking about the first colonization of, let's say, going back to 1584.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that if you read the literature on why, you know, Englishmen should come over, it was that it reads like current real estate promotional literature.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, come over, you'll make a killing. And they did. And, you know, I have to say that in many ways there's a similarity to what I'm talking about here to a rather well-known book in American history by Lewis Hart, 1955, called The Liberal Tradition in America, in which he says that there are certain societies that he calls fragment societies, and these are societies that broke off from a mother country like England and took from that mother country just one aspect of it, and that the people that left England and settled America basically... the fragment that they took was this hustling, aggressive, competitive mentality, and that became the American trademark. There's another book by Walter McDougall at University of Pennsylvania. He wrote a few years ago called Freedom Just Around the Corner, and he starts out by saying that we have always been, from the beginning, a nation of hustlers. That that is our dominant trademark, and that American English is the only language that has 200 synonyms or related words for the word swindle. And that, you know, he says when two Americans get together, you know, strangers, they come together to get to know each other or they meet or whatever, both of these people have an angle going. and they know the other person has an angle. And the goal is basically to promote yourself. It's to, you know, get your angle ahead so that you can extract money from the other person, really, and that's what's going on in any American interaction. And I'm guessing that a lot of our listeners now are nodding their heads and saying, yeah, story of my life in this country, because that's what Americans do. You know, I mean, you go to a party and people hand out their business cards, or the conversation is never really to get to know you. It's how can I promote myself? And all these books that we've seen, like The Brand Named You, you know, and all this, that's what Americans are essentially doing. And Alexis de Tocqueville observed it in 1830-31, you know, when he traveled across the United States. He said all conversations in the United States eventually come down to how much money is it going to bring in. That's what it's about. And so that was that is why America failed. I mean, you cannot run such a lopsided program and a fragment society and expect it to be a success. In fact, even the success is a failure, which is what I argue in the book. The original title, the working title of the book, was Capitalism and Its Discontents. Mm-hmm. And my editor, Wiley, was a little concerned. He didn't want to use the title because he said he really did want to sell more than 6 copies. So when my mother was alive, I could always guarantee that she would buy 4, you know.
So that would take you to 10. Well, I think hopefully we're going to do a little better than that, Morris.
Right. Experiment. The rest of the country would buy 2, and I would have a sale of 6. So, you know, I appreciated his point. He wanted something that grabbed people's attention, like Why America Failed. But I actually like the original title because it captures what I was talking about. Capitalism and its discontents is really the history. What we've got is a hustling mentality from day one, and then running parallel with that was a dissenting tradition. You could say that it starts with Captain John Smith in 1616 and the Puritan divines in the early 17th century, and it runs through Thoreau and Emerson and Lewis Mumford and Jane Jacobs and Vance Packard and John Kenneth Galbraith, and finally down to Jimmy Carter. Was the last stand, really, of the alternative tradition, although one would have to ask what the Wall Street protests are about. That's an interesting, you know, question. But what the argument I make is that that basically the alternative tradition never really had a chance in the United States because the dominant tradition was about the brand named you. And that is what has won out, and that is why we are in a state of collapse. It's finally what provoked 9/11. It's what provoked the crash of 2008. And it's why, in my opinion, the country really doesn't have a future and can't turn itself around. In fact, both, you know, from Arnold Toynbee to Jared Diamond, students of civilization that have watched the collapse of civilizations and have studied them, have said that in its final phase, what a civilization will do is precisely those things that will accelerate the decline. They do all of the wrong things. And you can see that happening now. You have, you know, a Senate and a Congress that's passing draconian laws about the United States can just, if it deems you a terrorist, it can just snap you up, put you in a black hole in Guantanamo, and you'll never be heard from again.
Or murder you, for that matter.
Right, that's right, torture you to death. And this, now legally, you know, I don't know if McCain-Levin bill has actually passed, but it'll pass. And so that's okay, you know, as far as that's concerned. Oh, it doesn't matter that it violates the Constitution. Who cares? Who cares about the Constitution? And Americans don't, most of them. And then you have the attempt, of course, that the economy, which collapsed because of this laissez-faire casino capitalism, neoliberalism, the economy is going further in that direction. Wall Street has not reined itself in by any means. It is in the business of accelerating the process of CDOs, leveraged buyouts, derivatives, and credit default swaps. It's just doing that even more than it was before the crash of 2008, although that was the cause of the crash of 2008. And so, you know, Jared Diamond and Toynbee and the others are right. What we're watching is the exacerbation of precisely the suicidal elements of the culture. And as I've, you know, often said in lectures and interviews, right now the chance of turning this around is roughly equivalent to that of turning an aircraft carrier around in a bathtub. It is not going to happen. It is not going to happen. We are not going to save ourselves, and we are just in the dying phase. And why America failed, quite frankly, is not an attempt to reach anybody and say, oh, we've got to do X, Y, and Z, and then things will be fine or better. Not at all. It's basically a postmortem. It's documenting why that can't possibly happen and what went wrong for 400 years. And so, you know, I mean, it's not what I would call an upbeat book.
No, I think you've captured that part
right.
of it there.
Although it's an interesting thing because I get lots of emails and even stuff on Amazon reviews just recently. I got lots of emails for people essentially saying, you know, instead of feeling bad after reading your works, I feel good. And the reason I feel good is I feel I'm in touch with reality. You are not feeding your readers BS, you know.
But do you feel bad, perhaps, Morris Berman, or do you consider that when you present this diagnosis, which is basically that it's over and there's nothing that can really be done, it's unrealistic and delusional to think there is something that can be done, that you then, for those people who might be struggling to do something positive, to salvage something, that you're just turning on the off switch for them too, so that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well, it could be. I mean, I honestly have no idea, but I do know that, you know, I mean, I have obviously an extremely tiny following, but I do know that that following has said to me in one form or another, I would just rather live in the truth. You know, I can't be deluded because they represent the alternative tradition that's always been marginalized and has never been able to turn things around. And what are the odds that that's going to happen today? That's why I say that the issue of Occupy Wall Street is an interesting issue, because the question is, what are their goals and can they turn anything around? But, you know, this is the type of thing that I want to address, that self-fulfilling prophecy or not, the historical reality is that the odds are way against anything like this happening. I also wanted to mention one other book that's not in this trilogy, Bob. I did a book a year ago, collection of essays called A Question of Values.
Yeah, right. I've been looking at it now. I had no idea it came out, Morris Berman. Your publicist did a bad job of getting this one before me.
Right, right. I basically self-published it on Amazon because no publisher wanted to take it. And so, but, you know, I have to say that Amazon has this division, which I think is wonderful, actually. It's called Create Space. And you don't have to fight editors and all this, the hoops that you have to go through. It was done within 3 months. They did a beautiful job, and it's selling very well, amazingly enough. But the thing that is important, I think, you know, for our listeners, or important for me to say to our listeners, is that only half the book is about our essays about the United States, but a couple of them are very important to me because they contain material that's not in the trilogy. In one essay, which is called Locating the Enemy, I talk about the whole question of America historically always having a negative identity. That is to say, not a bad identity, but an identity that was reactive. America never knew who it was because it started breaking away from England, and it always had to have an enemy or an opponent in order to define itself by, which created this kind of Manichaean, we're all good, the rest of the world or anybody who opposes us is all bad, and basically gave us a very warlike identity because at the center there was just an empty space, and it's something that we are afraid of looking at. There's another essay that is called Conspiracy versus Conspiracy in American History, which talks about unconscious programming that Americans have, again, going back to the late 16th century, but which you can see in the behavior of somebody like Barack Obama, or, frankly, the proverbial man or woman in the street in the United States. These programs are things like we are the city on the hill. We are a chosen people, and we become the model for the rest of the world. Obama said it when he went to Asia a couple days ago. He said, that the truth is that it's not that the Asians admire our power. Meanwhile, they're laughing up their sleeves, but it's not that they admire power, but they admire our set of values. You know, that's the thing. We're the city on the hill. And by the way, if countries don't agree with the program of becoming like the United States, we have a military that's very persuasive, that can move them in that enlightened direction. So this is one aspect of an unconscious program. Another is the concept of an endless frontier. Everything can be fixed. There's an infinite future ahead of us. It's largely technological, but there's no limit to expansion. And, of course, the foolishness of that is that we're living in a world with finite resources, and to believe in a philosophy of infinity means that you're going to hit a wall, and you're going to hit it pretty hard. We're not only hitting it socially and economically, but, of course, ecologically. And this is a very destructive philosophy. But again, it's we can solve all problems, we can do whatever we want. A third is extreme individualism. We don't want to do anything in a collective way. That's socialism, God help us. You know, what we need is just an Ayn Rand type of world in which the entrepreneurial individual strides forth and is the self-made man and so on and so forth. Well, you put all those together and it really is a recipe, first, for immense power, which, you know, we had. By 1876, 100 years after the founding of the United States, the U.S. was producing one-third of the world's manufactured goods. You know, that's not bad. That's pretty impressive. But finally, with that, these kind of unconscious programs, you are also dialectically going to kill yourself. And that's what we've done. The system is turning against itself now, and it's imploding. So I mention, you know, a question of values because it's an important piece of the equation. I never trained in American history. I mean, I was an historian of science, and I trained in European history and so on, and I was never really interested until about 1995, really. I was never really interested in the history of the U.S., and then for various reasons, I did become interested because I saw by 1995, while everybody was celebrating the supposed wealth we had, I saw that the United States was falling apart. And I became interested in its history, and I began to study and read about it. And really, it's actually quite fascinating. But finally, when you do all your homework and you read folks like Richard Hofstadter and Lewis Hartz and C. Van Woodward, you know, and the other great American historians, you see where the vector is going, down. And that's what we're caught in today. And it's why we have the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street protests and one out of five Americans unemployed with no hope of getting a job in the next 10 years and a lot of bitterness and depression and so on. It's because the system really is becoming unraveled with no possibility of reversing this.
Let me stop you there if I can, yeah. Morris Berman, just to reintroduce myself. I'm Bob McChesney.
Sure.
This is Media Matters. Our guest today you've just been listening to is Morris Berman, author of the new book, Why America Failed, The Roots of Imperial Decline. This is a live show where the phone lines are open here at Media Matters. The number 217-344-9455. The toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Another book that we've just been talking about, A Question of Values, a collection of essays by Morris Berman, is available also. If you go online, you'll find that at Amazon, I know, maybe elsewhere. Morris Berman, going back to your core argument, one of the things that is generally held up as a counterforce to hustling, to accumulation, to individualism and selfishness and egotism and greed is religion. And the United States, at the same time as being a hustling country, the other dominant theme I think that one has is that it's a country with a great commitment to organized religion of one form or another, that defines itself as a very religious country. How does religion, with its, you know, at least on paper, commitment to values opposite hustling, how does it fit into the picture?
Boy, that's a great question. You know, the classic answer was Max Weber, the Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, that in fact, the two go hand in hand very well, and that if you have a religion like the Protestant Ethic that tells you, or Calvinism that tells you, that wealth is a sign of being chosen by God, this is an enormous impulse for a powerful economic engine, because then you are blessed by this hustling entrepreneurialism, extreme individualism, and basically screwing the other guy. This becomes something that's actually blessed, because the wealth proves that you were chosen.
But I mean, I'm not a religious scholar, Morris Berman. You probably know a lot more than I do. But my sense is that for all of Max Weber's citations and that element in certain strands of the Calvinist tradition and Protestantism, you know, you can find 100 things that are sort of say the exact opposite, that are in elements of American religion that are quite critical of sort of selfishness.
Yes. And
how do those things work together? Why isn't religion a counterbalance sufficient to overwhelm the egotism and greed and selfishness of capitalism?
Right. I talk about that strain in the that's the early part of the alternative tradition, the early 17th century, with the Puritan divines and Captain John Smith and others. That certainly exists, and the thing is that it hinges on the notion of what constitutes virtue, which is a great, you know, important point for any religion. What does constitute virtue? And the traditional definition of virtue, going really back to the Greeks, but certainly prevalent in not only classical times, but in medieval times as well, virtue was what you contribute to the community. It basically, virtue was the ability to put aside your private interest for the larger good, the common weal. And that thread is certainly there in early American history. There's no question about that. And so you do have a lot of Puritan divines railing against the you know, private gain and the accumulation of wealth and usury and so on and so forth. That definitely exists in American history. It is complicated, though, by the factor that Max Weber talked about, that it was easy to be kind of play both sides against the middle and say one thing and do another, so that, you know, typically in the account books of early entrepreneurs in the United States, it would have it written at the top, for God and profit. I mean, they did go together in a certain way, but nevertheless, you're right. There was this attack on a life of pure entrepreneurialism. What did happen, though, over time, was that the definition of virtue began to change. Joyce Appleby, who's emeritus professor of history at Harvard, wrote a marvelous book about 20 years ago called Capitalism and a New Social Order, in which she argues that in the 1790s, the definition of virtue really began to change from the one I just mentioned before, contribution to the common weal, to making it in an opportunistic environment for yourself and your family. In other words, it underwent an inversion of 180 degrees. The thing is, she's linguistically correct. That did happen in the 1790s. But historically, it's probably antedated by about 100 years. There's a marvelous monograph by Richard Bushman, a historian, called From Puritan to Yankee, which is a study of Connecticut from the period 1690 to about 1765, something like that. And he basically shows that while there was this strain of, hey, how about a little self-control? How about contributing to the community? And so on and so forth on the part of Puritan divines, that slowly that began to lose ground. And so we went from Puritan to Yankee, and that way before the 1790s, regardless of what lip service was paid to the classical notion of virtue, people were out for themselves, and that was the dominant thing. Nobody really staked their lives around the classical notion of virtue as time went on.
And Morris Berman, sorry, continue. I didn't realize you.
No, go ahead.
I was just saying, we have a couple callers have been waiting patiently in the line, and let's draw them into the conversation. Our guest again today is Morris Berman, author of the new book, Why America Failed, The Roots of Imperial Decline. It's the third book in a trilogy. We've had Dr. Berman on in the past to discuss the first two books in the trilogy, The Twilight of American Culture and Dark Ages America, and a sterling read and one that is, if nothing else, sharply provocative. The number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champaign County, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Morris Berman.
Yeah, I immensely prefer the previous, the original title, the working title, and I think maybe the publicist or the book publisher was probably wrong, because we have this phenomena of a lot of people reading books about capitalism and actually questioning capitalism more than thinking that there might be another alternative more than ever. But I certainly take your point that the U.S. was this entrepreneurial and hustling sort of environment. One needs to remember that they were chartered colonies. They were actually corporate colonies from the very get-go. If you look into the history of the East India and the way the Crown chartered corporations actually started things here. But I wanted to talk about, besides religion as a countervailing impulse, we have the evidence from Bob's colleague, the success of the book,
John Nichols,
The S Word, talking about the whole legacy of socialism throughout this country. There was a countervailing. Now, history is always written by the victors, right? So it's pretty much unplumbed history. I think there's also a dimension of the early days with the proliferation of utopian visionaries, who more or less success in the working man's schools that existed around the Midwest in a big way, New Harmony, Indiana. There's a countervailing thread of this opposed to the hustle and more communitarian sort of impulse that I think gets overlooked, and perhaps in this book to some extent as well. So I'd like you to...
Well, thank you very much, caller. Morris Berman, the socialist tradition, the alternative tradition, maybe more pronounced than the dominant sort of picture wants us to know?
Well, these are good questions. I mean, these really are good questions. Let me take socialism first. I never read John Nichols' book. I did read the excerpt that he published in The Nation. And I have to be honest, I had a lot of problems with it, because a lot of what he was identifying as socialism didn't strike me as socialism. So I felt there was a lot of historical inaccuracy in what he was saying, and that he had blown things out of proportion or misidentified a socialist tradition. It's also the case that, there were the Wobblies, and during the 30s, for example, wildcat strikes that went on during the Depression. All that's true, but there have been so many authors, but starting from Werner Sombart to Seymour Martin Lipset, for example, who have talked about the whole question of socialism in America and why it never really managed to get off the ground. The rage, I mean, calling Obama a socialist or FDR a socialist, when basically what they, FDR was doing was saving capitalism, and Obama has no empathy for poor people. He's demonstrated that time and time again. So the calling of American president socialist is just laughable. But in terms of grassroots organizing and so on, it's never risen to the level of being effective, and the question is why. And there have been a lot of analyses about this, but the dominant one can really be identified with a remark that John Steinbeck once made. He said the reason socialism never took off in America is because poor people in America regard themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Everybody is a hustler in the United States, and everybody is looking toward how can I be a Bill Gates? How can I get huge cut of the pie and entertain on a lavish scale? Oh, Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? That's the national anthem.
Morris Berman, if I can just interject here to follow up, because I know the caller raised something else that relates to this. which is the term capitalism, which, mm-hmm. you know, has been, I think, for the last generation, at least since the 80s, has been sort of a sanctified term in American political discourse to which all pay homage. But one of the striking developments of the past 3 or 4 years has been that that term has fallen into disrepute far more than any other time in my adult lifetime. And not only that, what's striking, I don't know if you saw this, Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster and spinmeister who advises politicians on how to massage the public opinion, said that Republicans should stop using the term capitalism because polling shows that a significant percentage of Americans, including Republicans, now think the term is synonymous with greed, selfishness, and immorality, and it's not a winner.
I did see that. Right. And the fact is it's always been synonymous with that, but now we're calling a spade a spade, and you know, and that's great. But the fact remains that if you phrase it in another way, Yankee can-do mentality, ambition, and so on, what most Americans want is just a larger share of the pie. And the socialist tradition has been feeble in American history. I really disagree with John Nichols. As I said, I think he identified things as socialism that weren't. But let me take the other question, or the other part of the question,
okay,
the caller had, and that was, there have been Mennonite communities, Shaker communities, Oneida, there have been utopian experiments in the United States, and there has been a utopian streak for an alternative type of world. And I don't deal with the communities like the Shakers and so on in Why America Failed, because frankly, the literature on that is quite vast already. I mean, there's no, wouldn't be no reason for me to add to that. And so people can read about that. Again, this forms part of the marginalized tradition that in enclaves could pursue what they want to do, like the Amish, for example, today, but which never were able to influence the dominant culture. The outside of that, outside of these utopian communities and religious communities, we do have, however, the tradition I talked about, an alternative tradition that could be called spiritual, which was largely exhortatory. People like Thoreau and Emerson, as I said, Vance Packard and so on, that were basically saying, this way of life is a big mistake. And that does form an important body of literature, but there was only one entity, I don't know what else to call it, political organization, within that alternative tradition that had teeth, that had clout, and that was the American South. And I have a whole chapter on the Civil War and mm-hmm. the origins of the Civil War in this book. And, you know, I don't want to be misunderstood, and the worry that I had in writing it was that I would, in saying that the South was the only powerful political alternative to mainstream Northern capitalism, and it was willing to go to war over it. The war was not fought over slavery. It was fought over two conflicting worldviews. That's not to condone slavery. It's not to say that this was okay, and it's not to say that the war shouldn't have been fought to eradicate slavery. And so I want to be, you know, clear about what my position is, because it's always, you know, very, very iffy or dicey to say, hey, the South had a point, you know. But that is what I'm saying, following, you know, Eugene Genovese, the great, you know, historian of the American South. That really is what I'm saying. The South did have a point. It was a non-hustling culture, and it was the only non-hustling position or culture that we've had in the United States that really had teeth, that is to say, guns, and was willing to go to war for it. Thoreau didn't have any guns, and neither did Emerson, and neither did Vance Packard. And selling millions of books, which Vance Packard did, didn't really mean that the Americans were willing to follow what he said. And that's the point. You can be popular, you can run, you can sell millions of copies of the Whole Earth catalog, but that's just ascetic chic. It doesn't really amount to a non-hustling culture. And, you know, when Jimmy Carter made his famous spiritual malaise speech in 1979, by that time, Americans weren't going to, even though it was the end of the 70s, they were tired of all the L.L. Bean catalogs and Whole Earth catalogs and everything else, and they wanted really to get back to making money. And that's what, you know, Ronald Reagan said, hey, you know, it's a divine purpose. You should be doing this, you know.
Let's go back to the phone lines if we can right now. Our guest is Morris Berman, author of the new book, Why America Failed, The Roots of Imperial Decline. This is a live show, so feel free to call in at 217-333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers who have been waiting patiently up in Coles County. Let's get to them now, starting with line 4 in Coles County. You're on the air with Morris Berman.
Yes, you've stolen my thunder to some extent, but I was simply going to mention that this country has become a out-of-control greedy and out-of-control materialistic, and this in spite of the fact that this is in diametrical opposition to almost all the teachings of Jesus Christ, and yet we have many, if not most, conservatives claiming to be Christians and claiming that they are followers of Jesus Christ. So that's hypocritical, if not ironic, and so forth. And I thought I would simply mention that. You've sort of touched on that before, but I thought I would mention it.
Well, thank you very much, Coles County. If I can just follow up on that, because you have talked about that, Morris Berman, but you have mentioned, and we haven't gone into yet, both the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. And I'd like you to just talk about your assessment of both of those. And if you could draw in something you mentioned in the book, which I think is very important, the period from the mid-60s into the late 70s, this one period that many people of my age remember well because we came of age then, which was where there was a much larger sort of alternative vision that was in the dominant culture.
Right. Just to comment on the last caller's contribution and reference to, you know, how Christian we are and so on and so forth. There was a book published some years ago, I think it was during the 80s, Jesus CEO. I wonder what Christ would think of him being seen as a CEO, you know. That caller is absolutely correct.
Today it would be Jesus hedge fund manager.
Right, something like that. Now you wanted to talk
about
right.
Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, the current movements that are sort of, for lack of a better term, the more sort of grassrootsy movements that are going on, people who care about the future of the country and who are really out there saying, we have a vision here.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, the interesting thing about the Tea Party is that they are actually correct. They do have the original vision correct. The original vision was, hey, let's all make a bunch of money. And that's what they want to do. In other words, they don't want any socialism. They don't want any of this hippie sort of 60s or Occupy Wall Street, whatever that is, sort of thing clouding the fact that we are a hustling culture. We're an entrepreneurial culture. As far as they're concerned, probably Jesus was a CEO, and he would bless all this wealth and, you know, all those embarrassing statements about it's easier for a rich man to go to heaven than the camel to go through an eye of a needle. They don't want to talk about that. And what they want to talk about is that there should be no taxes, that you're free to make a killing, basically. And that's what America was about, and I agree with them. That was what America was about. It is what it's about. And so they're upset about all this, you know, stuff about welfare or a social safety net or all that's un-American. And they're right. It is. And so the Tea Party is basically an attempt to go back to the pure late 16th century version of what we were and what we should be and the Gilded Age and so on, and let's make a killing. And so in that sense, they're the true Americans, and I applaud them. Okay. Now, as far as Occupy Wall Street goes, how would I interpret that, or how should we look at that? The first thing that I would say is that when a body politic is as sick as ours is, it throws up antibodies. It really starts to produce people such as Chris Hedges or Naomi Klein or Noam Chomsky or, and at a much lesser level, myself, who basically are saying, red flag, this is not good. It produces antibodies that are trying to correct the sickness of the system. And so it's inevitable that something like Occupy Wall Street would emerge and say, we can't have a situation where there's 1% that has all this wealth and 99% that's scrambling for the crumbs. It's actually 1 in 90. That's the real distribution. 1%
of the top 1% of the American population owns collectively more wealth than the bottom 90%. It's a social distribution, a social inequity that is on the level of Egypt and Tunisia, roughly. So this is a large antibody that has emerged that is trying to correct this lopsidedness that Lewis Hartz talked about, this fragment society. So the question then becomes, what really is OWS? What really is the complaint? What is the demand? And here's where things get murky, at least for me. I haven't been to Zuccotti Park. I haven't walked around there. I haven't talked to people. And the impression I get, even from favorable reports on the net, seems to be what one would have to be called socialistic. This is a very poor distribution of wealth. This is an American dream for only the top 1%. This is not fair. What we want to do is spread the American dream around and redistribute wealth so that we have health care and all the other supports that, for example, we had much more of during the New Deal. This is our goal. If that's the case, then it's not really going to solve very much. It would be better than what we have today, but it doesn't go to the root of the hustling problem. The problem is the American dream. The problem is basing everything on infinity. And if the goal is to redistribute the American dream or distribute it better, that's very different from abolishing the American dream. And the real alternative tradition I'm talking about is the one that says, you can't live like this. This is not what life is about. And the American dream is an economic dream, and there's a whole lot more to life than that.
You know, in the book, in the book, Morris, just to touch on this book, is you do in Why America Failed, Morris Berman, you do I think you go at some length, in my view, some of your strongest writing deals with, you know, what you call the emotional climate of America and the suicide of a nation and sort of and I think you understand this too in your writing. There's a confidence that you're writing about sort of the inner misery of America. And I think this is what you're getting at, isn't it?
Yeah, hustling finally won't solve anything. You know, this is what Jimmy Carter talked about in that spiritual malaise speech. It's the only time I ever know of that a president addressed the American people and said, hustling is not the answer. Accumulating tons of consumer goods are not the answer. There has to be a deeper level to your life than this. And, of course, the response was to vote him out of office and to vote a drooling buffoon into office who said, life is about money. You should have it. Go get it. And so this is, you know, I mean, that election was one of the greatest of 1980, was one of the greatest landslides in the history of the United States, maybe the greatest. And to this day, when Americans are polled on their favorite president, Reagan typically comes out number one, ahead of George Washington or anybody else. That tells you where the American people are. And so the problem that I have, potential problem that I have with Occupy Wall Street is, if you're talking about redistribution, you're not really addressing the fundamental issues. It would be better, yes, to have that redistribution, but it won't save the country.
Let's go back to our phone lines. Now we have a couple of callers who have been waiting patiently. I want to make sure we get to them in the final 10 minutes of the show. Our guest, Morris Berman, author of Why America Failed. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. By the way, before I forget, 167 hours from now, our guest will be live and on the air, Noam Chomsky. I'm looking forward to the show, so be sure to tune in 1 week from today. Let's go now to line two, Coles County yet again. You're on the air with Morris Berman.
Yes, Mr. Furman, I read an essay just recently by a fellow, I think you pronounce it Niall Ferguson, who is a historian, I guess, of some repute, and he argues that Western civilization is actually the only hope for the world. Now, of course, there is a difference between Western civilization and America, but he points out some things that might counter your pessimism, one of which is Western empiricism. The rule of law, although interestingly enough, he also cites individualism as one of the great hopes. I was wondering if you'd like to respond to that, because that seems to be the more common story. story we'd hear from historians and whatnot.
Well, sure, sure.
Thank you very much, caller.
Yeah, and Niall Ferguson is a great proponent of empire. I mean, he you know, also wrote a book, you know, saying that the British Empire was the greatest thing since, you know, tinned pilchards or smoked salmon or whatever. And, you know, that's fine if you're talking about the people that are running the empire. If you're talking about the poor of Calcutta, it's a lot less convincing. But, you know, I do want to say this. Western civilization is a great historical entity. I mean, it has marvelous aspects to it, and the possible collapse of it would mean the loss of a lot of things that are fabulous. There's a lot of things you can say about it, that it was based in many ways on slavery. You know, I mean, think of a million slaves working in the Athenian silver mines, but that civilization also produced Plato and Aristotle. I wouldn't want to be without them. So in terms of making a case for the grandeur of Western civilization, personally, I don't think that's hard to do. I think we also, however, need to make a case for the downside of it. The problem, again, with the United States is that it really is a fragment society in Lewis Hartz's term. It took a certain thing from Western civilization, in particular from England, but it took a certain aspect, that of hustling and extreme individualism, and it made it the whole thing. Culture in the United States, or appreciation of Western civilization, is extremely small. You can ride the tube in London and listen to businessmen discussing the candidates for the Man Booker Prize for any year. Not only do they know who the candidates are, they actually have read the books, and they're discussing them, which should get the award and so on. Stop any American on the street, however, and say, who do you think should win the National Book Award this year? And the response will be, what's the National Book Award? Not only have they not read the books, they don't even know that such a thing is going on. They don't even know there's a National Book Award, that it might be important. Literature is not Western civ. That culture is of very little concern to the American people.
You know, Morris, can I interrupt you for 1 second? And just because I want to get to the last call, but I want to. You end the book sort of on this note, and what you do is you bring in your experience now living in Mexico, and you contrast that to what it was like living in the United States, just at a sort of an emotional, cultural level. And can you just talk a little bit about that? Because I thought it was quite striking.
Yeah, I mean, the impression, of course, you know, what you read in the American newspapers is 10% truth and 90% spin. Yes, yes, it's true that there are drug wars here, that there is a tremendous amount of crime, and that there is kidnappings and all that sort of stuff. But much of that is confined to border states, with one exception, Michoacán, an interior state. Daily life in Mexico is not about that, and daily life in Mexico actually is quite gracious, and it doesn't have this aggressive edge to it and competitive edge that I experienced on a daily basis just interacting with neighbors or people in stores or whatever in the United States. It really is a relief to live outside of all of that, and you can't imagine it until you're outside of it, because if everybody's doing it, which everybody's doing in the United States, then that's the norm, and then that's all you know. But, you know, it's slowly, I mean, I first visited Mexico in 1979, and I first visited Europe in the late 60s, and slowly it began to dawn on me that other people don't live like Americans live. They don't have the same values. They don't have that edge of anger and competition and aggression that is so normal in the United States that it's like a fish in water. If you ask a fish about water, it'll say, what water? You know, I mean, that's the last thing the fish is going to notice. And we swim in it in the United States. And once you're out of that and you get to normal human beings that are not raised in this hustler competitive mentality, the sense of relief is so enormous, I can't describe it. I love visiting the United States. I love going back and seeing my friends and all that sort of thing. But to be immersed daily in a
corporate, consumer, competitive wraparound culture is so depressing and so pesado, we say in Mexico, so heavy, that it's just a relief to be out of that.
Well, let's go to our final caller now. It's been waiting very patiently on the lines. Let's go to line one, Urbana. You're on the air with Morris Berman.
I find I believe with Mr. Agree with Mr. Berman's analysis to a degree. I'm very pessimistic myself. However, I'm troubled with his chronology. First of all, I think it probably is just a mistake, misspeaking himself, but the 16th century was the 1500s, and the sermon, the City on a Hill, was not at the end of the 17th century, but at the, I believe it was in the 1630s, possibly 40s, not early.
It was in 1630, but it was in the late 16th century. That is in the 1500s.
That's not the 16th century. It's the 17th century.
No. I'm talking about the settlement of the American continent, the colonization of the American continent.
Began in 1607.
Well, actually, the first literature about it was 1584. And,
all right, but that,
and people began coming over after that.
Yes. Well, I also have a problem with your attribution of Calvinism. The Puritans were not Calvinists. They struggled very much with the problem of reconciling God's all-knowing characteristic and free will. And perhaps the greatest of the Puritan thinkers, John Milton, arrived at the solution that man was a temporal being, God was eternal. Therefore, God knew the beginning and end, but did not determine them. The Calvinist, deterministic strain in American religion and thought comes in with the Scotch-Irish Presbyterians. And you find it in West Virginia, you find it in particularly North Carolina, and as they spread across Kentucky, Tennessee, and the southern Midwest, they had a profound influence upon American religious thinking. But this was not the Puritan strain, which was much more liberal.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, caller. And Morris Berman, we only have about 30 seconds or a minute left. Any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a long discussion about the ins and outs, the particulars of the theology. But as I said, there were Puritan businessmen that did have, it's well recorded, did have their books say at the top for God and profit. So, I mean, it's the ins and outs of the theology and how it actually played out in reality is something that would make for a long discussion. But I appreciate the, our callers calling me to task on exactitude. You know, always a good thing for an historian.
Morris Berman, I have a long list of things we have not talked about that your book inspired in me, and we could do a Jerry Lewis telethon. Just going over some of the issues we haven't gotten to. Unfortunately, though, we're rounding into our final lap here. Any last words, something that we haven't talked about in the book that you really would like to bring to our listeners' attention?
No, I think we covered a lot of stuff, Bob. And, you know, I mean, depending on your schedule over the next few months, I'd love to come back and talk about all this some more because as you... You know, I mean, a lot of historians tend to be windbags, and I'm, you know, probably at the top of the list. You know, I could just go on for, you know, several hours driving your listeners nuts, and there's no reason not to do it. I mean, you know. And so, you know, it's up to you, but I would love to do that. And
well,
there's
Morris Berman,
a lot more to talk about.
Speaking of, I'll have to cut you right there because I hear the band tuning up in the background. They want to clear me out of the studio. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to join us today here at Media Matters.
Thanks for the invitation, Bob.
Morris Berman, author of Why America Failed, The Roots of Imperial Decline, just published by Wiley. Urge you to take a look at it. And I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank Christina Williams, her first day as full-time producer today. Welcome aboard, Christina. And I also want to thank Kyle Croha, who's engineer working the board. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILAM 580, 167 hours from today, live on the air, Noam Chomsky. Until then, everyone, have a great week. See you later.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Cloudy skies in Champaign-Urbana today, a chance of rain, the high 50 degrees. Breezy conditions, west winds up to 20 miles an hour, gusts up to 30. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a chance of rain, the low 35 degrees. Cloudy skies tomorrow, a chance of rain or snow. Colder, the high 40. Mostly cloudy Monday night, the low 28. Mostly cloudy Tuesday with a high of 38. Tuesday evening, partly cloudy, the low 25 degrees. This is Illinois Public Media.